Thank you, Mr. Marcia. What does independence mean to you? Definitions from a dictionary. What does independence mean to you? We just went through this nation's celebration of the Day of Independence, which, if you didn't quite know history, might think that just means beer, hot dogs, but it's actually about independence. How would you define independence? I think sometimes we can equate it with the phrase of freedom, right? Well, independence is freedom. Maybe if I gain independence, I'll have more personal control over my circumstances. Historically, if you go back to the inception of this nation, our forefathers were pursuing freedom from tyranny, from the crown, taxation without representation, and that nasty, horrible man, King George. I mean, he was way over there, really had no clue about what's happening over here, and so it made sense that a nation should be formed, one that actually understands the circumstances, one that actually gets what's going on here, one where you can have a conversation with people. I mean, he wasn't listening to us, so therefore, must go. Independence later on in the timeline of our country meant emancipation from slavery. Having your independence, not having somebody rule over you in every portion of your life, your wife, your husband, your children, on where you would go, on what you would do, on how you spent your day. Perhaps also you might think of independence as an emancipation or a freedom from a controlling spouse. My wife and I are trying to raise, probably like many of you, if you have had the opportunity to be parents, trying to raise children who are going to become independent. Because one day I would like to not have to pick up all of the things. Currently, there are times where they make breakfast. A lot of times, they make breakfast for me. So it's like, we're getting there. This independence thing is happening. You're like, we're going to have independent children. I'm giddy. A little bit excited, right? But we want to have independent, we want to have moral, Christian, productive members of society, right? We want to have our children attain to that. Kids, on the other hand, I mean, you ask your parents something, they're like, no. And you're like, perhaps you don't do that. I did that as a kid. And I at times thought, well, when I turn 18, I will be independent. I will have say over what I do. Well, I'm here to cause your parents some duress, because I will tell you that you could even have it before then. You can be an emancipated child. You can be free from the tyranny of your parents and them paying all your bills for you and making sure that you have a roof over your head and the clothing and the food that they do. You can file to be an emancipated child, to sign your own contracts and make your own poor decisions earlier in life. Right? We want independence. Independence is just rooted in who we are as human beings. Today I'd like us to consider, though, what are we seeking independence from? Or for you, grammar astute, from what are we seeking independence? So I don't end it with the from. From what are we seeking independence or freedom? Let's turn over to Genesis 25. I'd like to look at the story of an individual. And we're going to follow this individual for quite a bit. This won't be the only place in Scripture that we're turning, but we're going to spend a good bit of time here. We're going to start off in Genesis 25, where we meet Two boys. Genesis chapter 25, verse 21 is where we're going to start off. Genesis chapter 25, verse 21. Rebekah has died. Abraham has remarried. Then Abraham dies. And Isaac and Ishmael bury their father. Now Isaac has been married for 20 years to Rebekah. I think I said Rebekah died. I'm sorry. Sarah had died and Abraham had remarried. Sarah had died. But Isaac is married to Rebekah. They've been married for 20 years. In verse 21, Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." So when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau, which means hairy. Afterward, his brother came out. His hand took hold of Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob, which means supplanter. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And what we get to see here in the life of these two boys is something that parents today never admit. My favorite brother-in-law, my favorite child, my favorite redheaded child, my favorite. We do all these things to make sure that it's like, oh no, we're not playing favorites. But we see here very quickly, there are favorites. And at times, we know, I mean, we pick our friends. You don't get to pick your family, but you get to pick your friends. You're like, oh, I like to hang out with people who I like spending time with, who we edify one another, who we get to have that iron sharpening iron, or we do the same sorts of things together. But we see here something that is initiated, or I shouldn't say initiated. We see something that is brought to mind here between these two boys. There are favorites. And this is another fun conversation to have when you get together as family. You can ask your siblings, who was mom or dad's favorite? And you will find there are two types of children. The ones who know and the ones who don't realize that they were the favorite. You'll be like, I don't know. I don't think mom or dad had any favorites. That's because it was you, right? That's how you know who the favorite is. Well, it's very clear here there are favorites. Now, with favorites comes conflict. Because you know, and I know, that the favorite one gets a pass on far too many things. So, being a human being, having been a child, I'm guessing that whenever Esau got into something, he went to dad. And whenever Jacob got into something, he went to mom. Because you know how to play the fiddle. And you know which fiddle to play. And so they're going. And so we have favoritism. We have injustice. And likely because as human beings, when we see favoritism, we see that injustice, we know that the one who's not giving us favoritism, they're actually kind of, sort of, not fair to us. They're oppressing us. There's a perceived oppression. That's why I don't go to them. I go to the other one because I would like to get a favorable outcome. Right, so we see the initiation of that. Going down to verse 29 to 34 here in Genesis 25, we see here more fuel added to the fire. Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me with the same red stew, for I am weary." Therefore, his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright as of this day." And Esau said, "Look, I'm about to die, so what is this birthright to me?" We don't really do birthrights in this country. I mean, you might have a will or generally got the birthright. The firstborn male got the birthright, and there was a responsibility that came with that. But what the birthright was, family of two kids, it's kind of a significant thing because they got a double portion, the birthright for the firstborn. Okay? So when you have two kids, that means one gets 67.33. You get two-thirds versus one-third. They're getting twice as much. And Esau's going, I'm about to die. I guess you didn't notice. And that extra third of something, you know what? I'd rather get a third of something because I'm alive than two-thirds of nothing because I'm dead. So he says, don't let me die here, brother. And Jacob's like, right on. I'll help you out. I am here to serve your needs, my brother. And so he helps him and helps himself. And this is something that doesn't quite set well with Esau. And so we get additional bit of conflict going on. Word. I would say the next almost two chapters here from 26 verse 34 all the way up to 28 verse 9, we see family grief. We see Isaac's poor choices and how he's going about describing his wife and marriage. We see Esau marrying people that cause his parents, at least his mother, no shortage of grief. He marries two women who are not of the family lineage, or actually from there around in that area. And so there's a lot going on between the brothers. We have the blessing that gets taken by Jacob, and Esau's response is like, oh, not only do you take my birthright, which is the double helping, but now you come in and you take the birthright. Or sorry, you take the blessing as well. Which is an interesting thing, because if you go back to the beginning when Rebecca is like, what is going on? Why is this pregnancy so difficult? God revealed to her that the younger was going to rule over the older and would be stronger. And so she knew this. And I think maybe to some extent she's like, well, I'll help that along. Kind of like what Jacob did when he's like, oh, I'll take that birthright. I'll help myself along. And so you get these bits of information that if you consider a relationship between people, you see this is just gonna explode. Stay tuned for next season. If it didn't happen now, it's gonna happen. You know it's gonna happen. Let's actually go to chapter 28. Actually, sorry, tail end of chapter 27, because we see here something. Not only did Jacob recognize that he had blessed, not only did Isaac recognize that he had blessed Jacob, but also when Esau knew that he had been duped, he's like, as soon as dad is gone, I'm going to kill you. And Rebecca heard about this, and she's like, I can't lose my husband and my son in the same day. Please send them off. So at the tail end of 27, chapter 27, verse 41, Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand, and I will kill my brother Jacob. And so Rebekah heard those, and so she gets Isaac to send Jacob off. And that happens in chapter 28, verse 1, says, and Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan, but you shall go to where your mother is from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. He blesses him and he sends him off. So Isaac sent Jacob away in verse 5, and he went to Padan Aram to Laban, the son of Bethuel, the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. And then you get Esau trying to make things right. If you've ever had a sibling rivalry, or maybe you didn't have it, but you recognize it, you can see these things going. Esau was like, oh, so they sent Jacob off to go marry the right person so the mom would be happy. I've married these other two women, and they just drive my mom nuts. So I'm going to try to make it right. And so he says, verse 6, Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob, sent him away to Padan Aram to take himself a wife from there, and that he had blessed him. He gave him a charge. And so Esau verse 8, saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father Isaac. So Esau went to Ishmael and took Mahalah, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebojeth, to be his wife, in addition to the wives that he had. So he's like, I figure I can make this work out, right? And so we have in this family a lot of dominoes set up in place. But at the same time, you might be thinking, well, I thought we were talking about independence. I thought we were talking about freedom. It's an interesting thing, because my question is, from what are we seeking freedom and independence? And here are these two brothers. They're not poor by any stretch of the imagination. You see what Abraham did when he goes and he defeats the kings and he gets his nephew Lot back. What their families had, they were not at a loss for things. They have wealth, they have means, they have the ability to do things. They, as the saying goes, well, it's probably not a good one for this one, the world is your oyster. They had their pick on what they did, on how they lived their life. And we see what they're choosing to do. We see how they're choosing to live. They're picking at each other. This is what Jacob's doing to Esau. And Esau's snubbing his nose at the blessing, the birthright that his father is giving to him or wanting to pass down. There's not a recognition of that. In Genesis chapter 29, verse 6. Genesis 29, verse 6. We get a whole new cycle of this. Only Esau's out of the picture. Jacob is finally free, independent. He's away from the threat of death, at least from his brother. Interestingly enough, didn't get the birthright, had to run because he angered his brother so much that he had to leave without getting the birthright, which is the double portion. He just gets up and goes. So, you know, it's better to have the possibility of 67% of something later than try to take it all now and die, which is what Esau had in mind for him. So he goes, and he goes on his journey in chapter 29. He meets Rachel in 29 verse 6. He sees Rachel coming in with the sheep, ends up meeting the family, and starts to work with the family. He works for Laban for a month, and Laban says, you know what? We're family. This is not right. I shouldn't have free labor. What's your going rate? What is the wage? What would you like to have as payment for your work? And Jacob says, oh, no, not payment. I'd like to be able to marry your daughter, Rachel. Works for 7 years, gets that promise fulfilled at the end of 7 years. Only surprise, surprise, it's her sister. There's a family theme there with the sister thing. Works another 7 years, but only has to wait, I think it's a week or something like that, before Laban says, okay, you can marry the younger one, even though you're already married to the older one. And so you have this cycle of family turmoil, fickle promises. You find out just in the agreement, it sounds like at the beginning, Laban, that's a stand-up guy. He's willing to ask. He's not trying to take advantage of Jacob. He says, you know what? You set your rate, I'll pay it. And then they have a conversation later on because the flocks are getting huge. He says, you know what? We need to be able to come to an agreement, because Jacob said, you know, I want to be able to start providing for my family. I've got like a bajillion kids now. I need to do something. I need to be able to set out on my own, perhaps to have some independence financially. And so they make an agreement about whether it's striped, speckled, streaked, the sheep in the flock. And what we find out is that actually Laban shifts that table to be by himself. And so he goes and he runs and he leaves. He's like, I'll go back to my father's house. Well, dad's dead. Mom's left. And so mom likes me. I'm mom's favorite. We're going to go back and go home. And we pick the story back. Genesis 32. Verse 1. So Laban has met with Jacob. Rachel has lied about the household idols. Jacob feels incensed. Jacob goes on his way, and the angel of God met him. 32. When Jacob saw that he saw them, he said, "This is God's camp," and he called the name of the place Mahanaim. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. So Esau is living in an area that is named after him. Jacob sent, he commanded to them, saying, "Speak thus to my lord Esau. Thus your servant Jacob says, I have dwelt with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight." And the messenger's return is also, he also is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. So what does that sound like? So Jacob has flocks. He's kind of trying to send a gift basket, if you will. Perhaps they left on tense terms, if you could say that. Esau wants to kill him. He's running away. He's on his mom's home turf, so the brother doesn't have any say in it because he's with Laban. So I'm going to be protected with family. They're going to have my back. He stays there for 14-ish years, right? Then he comes back, and he's coming back home. He says, I've got all this stuff, and I'm going to send this gift to you. Maybe it will ease the tension. Now remember, he never took the birthright. So he actually left with the blessing. And one could argue, not much. He didn't really experience that blessing much. He saw his flocks increase, but he's just living with strife. He's now got wives who are fighting over him, handmaids who are like drawn into the battle lines, and you have sibling rivalry of his own children, and you have his father-in-law, who is and his servants and hired men who are coming after him. You read the story, it really is a soap opera. It really is this full of drama and difficulty in this family. So verse 7, Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him and the flocks and herds and the camels in two companies. Because it sounds like, if you're a thinking person and you're considering, you're not just sitting here reading this, you're like, ooh, I know how I left the relationship with my brother. That gift I gave is not enough. I don't know what more I can give, right? He might think, I'm coming back for the two-thirds. And you see Esau's got 400 guys coming. I imagine that of those families that Abraham had 300 armed men, that those stayed in the household of Isaac. And then when Jacob left, I don't think he brought them with him to go over to be with Laban, because he's there by himself having to be in the household of Laban. So they're over there, and Esau has them. Whoever those people were who were servants to Abraham have now, and we're now up to 400 armed men at least that he's coming with. Who knows how many he left back at home, but he's coming. It sure seems pretty precarious for Jacob. And so he's greatly afraid. He divides everybody up. And then verse 8, he says, if Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the other company, which is left, will escape. So he is looking down the road and says he sees doom and gloom. Verse 13, so he lodged there that same night and took what came to his hand as a present for Esau, his brother. So he's gathering more gifts. He'd already sent one delegation gift basket out. He's sending another. And what he's sending now is 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milk camels with their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 foals. But he delivered them to the hand of his servants. Every drove by itself and said to his servants, "Pass over before me and put some distance between successive droves." And he commanded the first one, saying, "When Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, saying, 'To whom do you belong and where are you going? Whose are these in front of you?' Then you shall say, 'They are your servant, Jacob's. It is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, he also is behind us.'" So he's trying to maybe ease back some of that tension. Maybe if he thinks I'm coming for his stuff, and he sees all of these gifts, perhaps he'll have a change of heart. Jump down to verse 22. So he has those presents all set up. And he arose at night, took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. And he took them, sent them over the brook, and sent over what he had. So he's sending his servants out one way, and he's sending his family another way, separating them out, hoping that, you know, maybe if there are enough separations and divisions, somebody can get through this. Part of my family is going to survive because, again, Esau wants to kill him. Chapter 33, verse 1. Now Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two handmaids. And he put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last. There's no favoritism here. He's just, you know, he's prepping. And he crossed over before them. At least he went first, right? Then he crossed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. The amount of work and effort that Jacob put into supplicating himself and trying to ease the tension in a relationship that he had with his brother is not to be overlooked here. What was Jacob trying to be free of? What was he trying to be independent of? Through all of this, it's an interesting journey of injustice, of oppression, the threat of death. All of that. I mean, it's just, it's in here. This is why I kept saying this is like a soap opera drama. Everything is here. You got, I mean, at least a couple different miniseries talking about all of the things that are going on in this family and how to get over the hurdle of the difficulty that's there. People want to be, he just wanted to go this route, go back home. I can't be here with Laban. Well, he was only there with Laban because he couldn't be at home. He keeps running from these issues. He keeps trying to get free of them. Maybe if I'm over here, I won't have that problem. Maybe if I do these steps and try to placate my brother, maybe I won't have that problem. He's trying to get free of his past in many ways. Let's go over to Romans chapter 7. Romans chapter 7. We'll pick it up in verse 1. Romans chapter 7, verse 1. Much like our forefathers in this nation, and likely everyone who has ever thought about having freedom or pursuing independence, there is a relationship that has gone sour. There is a relationship that is not what it once was or what it was desired to be. And there's a desire for freedom from that injustice, from the oppression, from the death, from those negative aspects of that relationship that might be built into it. Paul here speaking in Romans chapter 7 verse 1 says, "Or do you not know, brethren, for I speak to those who know the law," so those who understand God, "bear fruit to God. For when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions," taking my brother's stuff, maybe being a little bit sneaky about how I get wealthy off of my uncle, maybe cheating my nephew and saying, "I think I can get another 7 years out of this guy. Let's switch things up." "The sinful passions which were aroused by the law were at work in our members to bear fruit to death. But now we have been delivered from the law, having died to what we are held to, what we are held by, so that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, 'You shall not covet.' But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desires. For apart from the law, sin was dead. I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. And the commandment, which was to bring life, I found..." For sin taking occasion by the commandment deceived me, and by it killed me. Therefore, the law is holy, and the commandment holy, just and good. Paul is trying to talk about our perception of the things that we need to be free from. That law, those family rules, they're so oppressing. They don't let what I really want to do. If only they were done away with. If only you could nail them to the cross. If only, fill in whatever you would like. We see them as oppressive sometimes, overbearing, restrictive. Carrying on. Verse 13, has then what is good become death to me? Certainly not, but sin that it might appear sin was producing death in me through what is good, so that sin through the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. You watch, I shouldn't say watch, you read the walk of Jacob, his brother Esau, his uncle, his wives, his mother, his father, his grandfather, his grandmother. It's rooted in carnality. It's rooted in pursuing these things where we think we know the way. It's independent. It's free thinking. We have the authority to do that. Look at us. We're independent. We're free. Verse 15, for what I am doing, I do not understand, for what I will to do, that I do not practice, but what I hate, that I do. If then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it is good, but now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that is that which is good, I do not find. For the good that I will to do, I do not do, but the evil I will not to do, that I practice. And this is the struggle. Paul's saying, you know what? I grasp that there's a difference, that we have been called as Christians, as followers of Christ, to live a different way. It's hard. He says, I'm trying, but I'm failing. I'm not able to make it. I wish that I could be free from that way. Verse 20, now if I do what I will not to do, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. I find then a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man. But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me? Who will free me? Who will grant me independence from this body of death? I thank God through Jesus Christ, our Lord. So then with the mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. He really brings it to a point there. He says, you know what I want to be free of? I want to be free of this wretched body that delivers me to death. I want to be free of this man, this way of thinking. And we watched it played out. We read it played out in the life of Jacob, one of the patriarchs whose name is changed to Israel, a man who was faithful, a man who ended up telling Pharaoh, you know, wicked and few are my days, as he looked back at what his life produced. Paul puts the words to it of what we just read. Oh, wretched man that Jacob was, going through and doing these various things. He's trying to escape it, but you just keep seeing him pulled back in with all the poor choices. You're like, what? That's how you think you're going to fix it? And all the people around him, righteous individuals, as we understand it, tied to this family that God has given a promise to, who wants to have them be a model to the people around them. And you've got Pharaoh and you've got Abimelech going like, why would you do this to me? And you've got different people seeing how they're responding to one another. You go through this whole book of the Old Testament and you just see this constantly, people trying to escape, to emancipate themselves from a way of thinking and a way of life and a mindset that is so debilitating, so cyclical in its nature, that it brings them right back to destruction every single time, all the way down. But so often in our life, what we're seeking is how to get out of a situation, how to get out of a circumstance. I don't like how this is, so I think that the way to fix it is to go kill a goat, put its hide on my arms, and see what I can get from my dad for a blessing. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Now, we might chuckle and say, because we don't do that in this culture, but how many times have we found ourselves in a pickle and said, I'm pretty sure this is the way out, just to find out that it's not. Oftentimes, we are too busy looking for how to be free from, insert whatever it is, free from injustice, free from oppression, free from death. It's the wrong way to look at it. What we should be doing is trying to pursue freedom through. Not freedom from, but freedom through. Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 28. Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 28. Pick it up in verse 20. Genesis 28, verse 20. We see here Jacob beginning to get it. He starts to get it. It's a wonderful thing. It's like when you see the protagonist finally figure out how to defeat the enemy. It's like Tony Stark has that aha moment. He's like, that's how I'll get the gauntlet from Thanos, for all of you Marvel Universe people. And if you're not, sorry if I offended you. But we see here that Jacob begins to get it. Chapter 28, verse 20, we read, then Jacob made a vow. This is as he's leaving his house, going towards Laban's house, and he has a bit of mind to take some time out, and he makes a vow saying, if God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going, give me bread to eat and clothing to put on so that I come back to my father's house in peace, and the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. He's getting it. He's not quite there, because he says, if you're going to keep blessing me in the way that I'm going, well, wouldn't that be nice, because I decided to go this way. That's not how God works. But at least he's thinking somewhat outside of how he had been. He takes time to stop and say, hey, will you be with me on my journey? And sometimes we have to step back and realize that the request should be slightly different. And he does make a slightly different request. Let's go to chapter 32, verse 9. Genesis chapter 32, verse 9. Now, he has left Laban. He's on the verge of meeting up with his brother Esau. And in Genesis, a very hard time returning. He recognized that God had actually answered his request from when he had crossed over the Jordan the last time. He's like, I'm coming back with two companies. He says, deliver me, verse 11 here, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I and the mother with the children. For you said, I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. What we see here, he's still making some fairly bold petitions, but at the same time, he's acknowledging what God had told him in the initial vision when he said, you need to leave your land. Go to your father's household, Isaac's household. He's saying, you said this. I'm going to hold you to that. He's at least remembering that there's someone, something that is outside of himself. Going down to verse 24 in Genesis 32. Genesis 32, verse 24. Now, he's left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now, when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him, and he said, let me go, for the day breaks. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall be, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. Jacob's life was a struggle. It was hard. It was hard because he kept pursuing his own way to freedom. He was trying to get free from so many things that he didn't realize that he needed to pursue freedom through that relationship with God. Verse 29, and Jacob asked, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, Why is it that you ask about my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. He recognized who he was with, that he was in the presence of God, and that he had been blessed. And it changed who he was. We see a similar sort of exchange in the book of Ruth. Let's turn to Ruth. Chapter 1, verse 16. Ruth 1, verse 16. Naomi has told Ruth to go back to her people because her husband has died. Naomi's husband has died. Ruth's husband has died. But Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." It's so intriguing to me that in Ruth's calculus, what she promised to Naomi was servitude. And through that servitude, what did she gain? Freedom. She gained a husband. She gained a family. She gained heir. She's listed in the lineage of Jesus Christ. It's a wonderful example. She says, "Where you go, I will go." You see the difference in what Jacob said. He's like, "I recognize I am struggling with you." And he asked for a blessing. It was a different person. He recognized that him finding his own way, directing his own path, was not something that he could do. It wouldn't lead to freedom. You can do it, but I tell you, it's hard. You go down that path, and you recognize that you're not going to get anywhere good. Everybody tries to be free from somebody else, some situation, the circumstances that they're in. And we can fail to realize that if we want true freedom, true independence, we only get that through submission, as Jacob did when he was wrestling and he was given the name of Israel. Through obedience, through love, we get freedom through that. We move from a slavery to sin, where we're trying to pursue that. We're slaves to that. It's hard to get out of that cycle. We see this actually manifest, captured in a portion of Deuteronomy. This is such a beautiful passage. When you realize what it means, it is not just how God wanted his nation to treat one another. It's not just how he wanted his people to view finances. It's not how he wanted them to look at one another. But it is a microcosm of what you and I have the blessing of being a part of. Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 12. It says, "If your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you and serves you 6 years, then in the seventh year you shall let him go free from you." I don't think it's a coincidence that Laban had Jacob serve 7 years for each of his wives. It says, but verse 13 here in Deuteronomy 15, "And when you send him away free from you, You shall not let him go away empty-handed. You shall supply him liberally from your flock, from your threshing floor, and from your winepress. From what the Lord your God has blessed you with, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this thing today. And if it happens that he says to you, I will not go away from you, because he loves you and your house, since he prospers with you. You look at the relationship that that Jacob had with Laban. And there was a time where Laban recognized, he said, please, please don't go. You must know that I recognize I'm blessed because you're here. I know that God is blessing me because you are here. And that seemed to have gotten forgotten along the path, because then Laban's sons are saying, man, he's just taken everything that you had. But the daughters recognized, they said, our father had actually spent all of the inheritance. There's nothing going to be coming to us. The only thing that we have is with you, Jacob. Wherever you're going, we're going. You'll take care of us. So Laban had been irresponsible with what he had in his charge. But when we're talking about this liberality, he says, he's been there with you. This indentured servant who's been with you for 6 years, let him go out on the seventh. He's been a blessing, and give him liberally from all that you have been blessed with. Verse 15, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this thing today. And if it happens that he says to you, I will not go away from you, because he loves you and your house, since he prospers with you, then you shall take an awl and thrust it through his ear to the door, and he shall be your servant forever. Also to your female servants you shall do likewise. It shall not seem hard to you when you send them away free. He's talking about the attitude of the person. You shouldn't have a bad attitude when you send them away free. For he has been worth a double hired servant in serving you 6 years. Then the Lord your God will bless you in all that you do. The desire here is that if someone recognizes they're in a bad place and they need to become a slave, to place them into a household, into a environment where they can come back from the debt that they owe and have the opportunity, if by chance, to go out and start anew, free, to have a blessing of whatever they have with them. And there are other places it talks about whether they're married, if you're given the wife while you're there, they don't go with you, but you could. But the principle is you send them out liberally, giving to them liberally, caring for them, to give them that fresh start. But what would it be like if the person who initially was just thinking, you know what, I can't wait till I'm done with this payment of debt. When I'm done, 6 years from feeling oppressed, they want freedom from things, but they don't realize that we actually gain freedom through being someone else's servant. Because there are two types of people. Two types of people. Let's go to Romans chapter 6. We'll see those two types. Believe they're going to gain independence by pursuing their own way. But what they end up doing is getting shackled to the very thing that they're trying to escape. Because there's no possible way that we can gain independence. There are a couple parables, there are a couple examples if you wanted to jot them down just for your notes. We won't go there for the sake of time, but Luke 12:16, we see if you rely on yourself, you can build yourself a bigger barn, but there's no guarantee, fool, tonight your life will be required of you. Tax collector, I thank God that I fast twice a week, unlike that tax collector over there. Well, who went home justified, Jesus asked. The individual who is willing to recognize that he couldn't do it by himself. One is trying to. If only I can snatch my brother's birthright. If only I could get more sheep than my uncle. If only I send all of these sheep to my brother, then finally we can bury the hatchet. We can be done with this strife. We can be free of that cloud that's been hanging over me. But there's no way to be free of that. We see that there are still wars going on in the Middle East. That cloud is still there. Proverbs 21:2 also tells us that every way of a man is right in his own eyes. We can't figure it out on our own. Romans chapter 6, verse 16 is where we'll wrap things up. Romans chapter 6, verse 16. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one's slaves whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness? There are two types of people. There are slaves to sin and slaves to righteousness. Somehow in the middle of all of this, we have been sold a bill of goods that we can find freedom and independence. If only you could be free of someone telling you what to do. If only you could be independent and make your own choice, you will not surely die. For in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will understand good from evil. It's the same lie. And dare I say, we live in a nation, and it's a very blessed nation. It's an amazing place to live. But our entire continent has swallowed that lie, hook, line, and sinker. And we're choking on it. And everybody wants it. But they're pursuing the wrong thing. Carrying on here in Romans chapter 6, verse 17. But God be thanked, that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. I speak in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh, for just as you presented your members as slaves of uncleanness and of lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves of righteousness for holiness. While those around us pursue freedom, I hope that we all pursue this kind of slavery.